My name is Jay Washburn.
And I'm Joe Bendosky.
And this is Start Writing. So we've had a lot of people ask us about, we've been podcasting for years. Do you remember how long it's been total, Joe?
Two or three, I think.
Yeah, it's at least two. Yeah, I don't know if it's beyond three yet. I can't remember, but it's a lot. And we have a lot of episodes. And we have had listeners ask us, well, where do I start? You have such a large library. And we definitely have some episodes that are most popular, but for beginners, we don't necessarily have a great place to start. We go really deep into topics, and they're extensive, and we kind of just recommend that if you're interested, find one that you need to work on and go dive into that. As you know, you guys can tell that Joe does most of the groundwork behind this. When we started this podcast, I told him, you're Batman, I'm Robin. And that means he's leading the charge on most of these. Well, on basically all of them. But we discussed this and we discussed the question coming in about where do I start? And we decided to do this little mini series, and I am taking the lead on it. And it's a beginner's guide to writing a novel. And I think I just want to warn you ahead of time that I don't consider this necessarily definitive, but it's definitive for me. This is the way I think about things, and I'm hopeful that the way I do things, the way I write novels, will be helpful to a beginner. And that's what I'm intending to do. It's interesting. I just finished an MBA program. A lot of my classmates, when they heard that I was an author, they would tell me, oh yeah, I've been working on this book project. Even one of my professors, we talked about it. And so this is to you guys. This is my answer to your question. How do I get started? So we're going to be going through that. There we go.
Oh, I think your sign should have said a beginner's guide to start writing a novel.
I know. Okay, so the truth is, I thought about layering that in there, and then I didn't know if it was too corny. I went through a bunch of titles, to be honest. But okay, so when I took my first creative writing class, this was I first started college. I was a freshman, and I took creative writing, and I thought at the time, being an author is not a viable career, so I'm not going to pursue that, but I'm going to take this creative writing class for fun because that's what I really cared about. And my teacher recommended that I read a book called Character and Viewpoint by Orson Scott Card. And hopefully you've heard of this, but maybe you haven't. He has something that he calls the MICE quotient, and that stands for milieu, idea, character, event. And I like that, and that helped me kind of start my author journey over a decade ago. But since then, my perspective has shifted a lot. And I'm currently working on a project. It's called Starchild. It's a sci-fi space opera. And I'm about to publish the third book. It's right on the cusp. But in Starchild, there's something called the Braid. And it's kind of a framework for the magic system. And it claims to be a framework for everything. Like, you can understand the universes by aligning it with the Braid. And just to show you how crazy deep I've gone, this is a little spreadsheet, but it just lists a bunch of different facets of life, essentially, and how they line up with the Braid. But that is an alternate title for what I want to teach you today. I want to show you how three key points weave together into what I think of as story making. So on this slide here, you'll see on the right, I have Orson Scott Card's idea and event. To me, he talks about those as two types of stories. And to me, this is a story that is plot heavy. It's about obstacles and problems and solutions and crises and winning and losing and restoring order. So that's one of the facets that we're going to be talking about today and in this series. Next he has character. That's probably a better name than what I picked, but I'm calling it hero. There are stories that drill in on the hero and emphasize that. And then last, he has milieu. Most of the time in screenwriting or fiction in general, they call this setting. And I like milieu. He's trying to kind of expand it. I'm just going to call it world. And what I mean by world is that it's the setting. It's where things take place, but it's a little bit more than that. sometimes it's the concept that goes along with the setting. And I'll give you an example. So Harry Potter happens in almost modern day England, or sorry, almost contemporary England. And it happens at a castle, which in the movies they filmed it at Oxford. Like, that's the setting for Harry Potter. But the world is a little bit bigger than just the place. And it means there's magic. This is an England with magic. And it's not simply the green grass. It's the way the society works. And it's a little bigger. So I'm going to call that world.
Yeah. Well, I can kind of see why Card called it milieu. Because, you know, like you said, it's bigger than just that. Like if we take things out of the sci-fi fantasy realm and just move into the contemporary world, you can have, you know, a beach summer romance taking place in our contemporary world, and the same thing you can do with kind of a gritty noir detective novel. But the mood and the feel of those two worlds, while they're contemporary, is still very different.
Yeah, that's true. That is an excellent point. So I deviated. So my background is in user experience design, and basically what that means is you're working on software and you try to make it as simple and straightforward and foolproof as possible. And so it's that kind of mindset that makes me avoid this French milieu word and think, well, how can I simplify that and make it a little more accessible? Because to be honest, when I approach that word, I'm like, I don't even know how to say that. So I'm just trying to make it.
Yeah, I think as an experienced writer and spending a lot of time thinking about setting and, you know, everything down to just like, what word do I use to describe this setting as a way to set the mood for my chapter, gives me a very different approach to that word than, like you said, this is for beginners. And so if you're very first thinking about it, I think world is maybe a better word for it.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm just trying to make it very simple. So I'm calling it plot, hero, and world. And we're not going to focus on this a ton, but to me, there's something kind of underlying all those as the foundation, and it's I'm going to call it the theme, but it's something a little bit harder to tack down. So, okay, so today's objective for you listeners, this is my objective for you, and I hope you're on board with this. As we talk about these three pillars of the braid of writing, right, I want you to think about which one are you best at, and how can you take that strength and lean into it? How can you make it stronger? But then I also want you to think about, okay, then where does that leave a weakness in your writing abilities? And how could you zoom in on that one and make it stronger? Okay, so I'm gonna talk about this over and over, these three pillars. Another way to think about it is the what, that's the plot, the who, that's the character, the hero, the cast, I guess, and then the world is the where and the when, right? Yeah. And on this slide, I've drawn, if you're just listening to the audio, I've drawn a bunch of arrows that go from each of these parts to all the other parts. And that's, again, that's the braid. Like, we want these to weave together so each of the three pillars are supporting each of the other ones. And together, they become really strong.
So I guess to illustrate this, I think this interconnection of who, what, where, and when. If we think of Harry Potter, this example you've mentioned before, if you think about the world where this takes place, it's this magical world, but they have been traumatized so significantly by Voldemort that they do not even dare say his name in public, right? Mm. Like, that's how significant an impact he has had on their world. And then you have Harry, who is magical, but he has not grown up or even known about the magical world until he is much older. Even Hermione is familiar with the concept of Voldemort, right? And so in this what and where and when and who, Harry then becomes the ideal protagonist because he is the only person in the wizarding world who has no hesitation to investigate, learn about, and question the whole Voldemort thing. Because it has no emotional connection for him, right? He's like, you know, and his connection to Voldemort is he hates the guy, killed my parents. He's angry about it, right? He's motivated to make sure he's not coming back. And it is that combination of his unfamiliarity with the cultural taboos and his anger and the fact that he's a wizard who makes him the ideal hero for that story.
Dude, that's cool. That actually illustrates his principle perfectly.
Yeah, it's woven together.
That's super cool.
What, when, and where all fits together in why Harry. Because he's not the best wizard. That's Hermione, right? You know, he's not raised in this world like Malfoy with you know, all of those connections. Anyway.
And I just think, kind of to an example of your point, how he's one of the ones who says Voldemort the word instead of he who shall not be named. And so, like, he is that outsider.
He never says that. He just says the name.
And it's cool, too, because then you can kind of, you go on that journey with him because the reader is an outsider, too.
Yeah.
And it pulls you along. Okay. So next, I've shown the why or the theme as kind of this this foundational layer. And we're not going to talk about it a ton, but I'm going to talk about it right now. I think the why is essentially the most important part of all this. And your who, what, and when, they need to tie into this why in a very deep and meaningful way. And I've written some examples here. So like I need to connect that too with the why is an emotional thing almost always. And so for example, why a plot matters is the reader's going to say, well, it's because it's exciting, or it's because it makes me curious, or this helps me escape. Right. And those are all emotional responses that make the why, this is why I'm reading the fiction. It's because of one of these emotional feelings or emotional current. If you're writing a book that's about a hero, your readers are going to say things like, oh, I really identify with this character, or man, I'm so worried about what might happen to him or her. And then going along with the world, you're going to hear your readers say stuff like, well, this world fills me with longing. Or if it's Game of Thrones or something like that, they're going to say, this place terrifies me so much that I can't look away. But you'll notice that all of these whys are an emotional response to what's going on as we're braiding our story.
Well, so anytime my mom has seen a movie she really likes and she calls me up and she wants to tell me about it, the first thing she'll start doing is telling me who the actors are in the movie. And I always remind her, Mom, I don't care. What's it about? Right? Because her focus is character. My focus is plot.
Yeah.
And then to take this to the next step, when I'm looking for a new book in various emails that I get or just on Amazon, I look at the cover, and what I'm looking for, because the cover doesn't tell me about the plot or anything, is I'm looking for a world that interests me, right? And then I will read, you know, the blurb to see if the plot interests me as well. But just for me, plot is very important, but world is also key. And then hero, I meet them along the way.
Mm-hmm. Dude, that's perfect. I love how that contrasts with your mom.
Yeah, she's so funny. You're like, I don't care who's in it. What's it about?
That's so funny. And then I just put a textbook on here. And when people are reading for knowledge, like sterile knowledge, I'm not looking for emotion. I don't need a response. I just need to know something. That's where a textbook comes in. And we don't want to write a textbook. We want to make these emotional connections with our readers. Okay, one more way to think about it. Plot is future. What is about to happen to this hero? And character is past. What has this hero been through? What has shaped him to bring him to this point? And then world is present. What kind of environment is the hero in right now? Actually, I may skip this one. So yeah, I did a master's in rhetoric, and I think it kind of aligns with those two. The quote on the screen, I'm going to read it. Everything needs a purpose. Every chapter, every scene, every paragraph, every sentence, every word. And if you're listening, you're saying, well, why did you just use five different things to emphasize this point that everything needs a purpose? And that's a call that I had to make as the author of this passage. But I wanted to reemphasize. So as I add every scene, every paragraph, each of those, I am making the call that the purpose of this is to drive it deeper, to go deeper.
Well, and there's a technique from rhetoric that you're using right here, which is that rhythmic repetition. Mm. Every, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I would argue that this is purposeful, even though it's repetitive. And you could ask, well, why didn't you say every punctuation mark, right? You can go smaller than word. And that's a call you have to make as an artist and an author. You have to decide, well, how much is needful and how much is going to ring true with my readers? And so just an example of that, there's a character named Cal in one of my novels, and you go for quite a while never knowing really anything about her family. And then there's a point where it becomes important to know that she has sisters. And I knew, as the author, I knew all along that she had sisters because I'd written this big character sketch that like fleshed out her life. And in the end, it needs to have a purpose if it's going to get into your braid, right? If it's going to go on the page for the reader, it needs to have a purpose. And so if your characters have sisters, don't talk about them unless those sisters are going to be important at some point. And then, well, you'll want to bring it in and you'll probably want to foreshadow it a little depending on what they do. But okay. So now in this next segment, well, actually, let me explain this first. So I recently went and saw the Broadway musical adapted into a Hollywood musical of In the Heights. And in that movie, there's a guy driving a cart down the street and he's selling piragua, which I had to go, you know, Google the word. Piragua just means snow cone. And it's, I don't remember if it's Dominican or I can't remember which country it comes from. But so I want to tell you that piragua means snow cone. And what I mean by that is I want to go through these three facets. And I want to tell you what they mean to me and kind of how I see them and how I frame them, because this episode is the introduction and we're going to dive deep into each of them in the coming weeks. And I want to essentially build a foundation that makes it so that we're all on the same page. Okay. So first I want to talk about a book that I think has a stellar plot. And when I say that the Da Vinci Code has a stellar plot, I mean, it's one of the fastest books that I've ever read. Like, you're literally just flipping pages. You're so excited to see what comes next. And incidentally, the chapters are all really short too. And I think that gives you a sense of that really fast pace. But for me, the driving question in that novel is just, what's going to happen next? Now, on my slide here, I've then rated the character or like hero in that book, and I actually give it a very low score on character. And I feel like if I didn't say his name here in a second, I'm guessing most of you wouldn't remember. The hero's name is Robert Langdon. And it's honestly not a huge part of the story. Like, what matters is they're trying to discover the Holy Grail, right? It's a quest for the Grail and they're traveling all over the world. And the character, like, I've looked for the details that go into his history, and, you know, well, he's a professor, he likes to swim, and he's got a Mickey Mouse watch. But what you don't have is him saying, you know what, I have a daughter and she needs an organ transplant, and if I don't finish this Grail quest, she's gonna die. Like, there's no real personal stake for him other than, well, I don't want to get shot by these bad guys and I'm trying to do the right thing and help out the good guys. I don't think it's terribly deep on character. Now, that said, I don't mean to knock this novel. This is actually one of my favorite novels. I love it. I think that the bad guys in particular have much stronger character arcs or I guess personalities than the hero does. Silas in particular, but also the teacher. And then I gave it like decent marks for world. I just think the international travel part, everybody loves that. That's a big draw for the book. And then, of course, just the concept of the Da Vinci Code and this idea that we're going to find the Grail if we can follow these clues and solve these murders.
I definitely agree with you on character. And I think the insane pace of the book is part of what limits the character, because he can't slow. He doesn't slow down to ever explore the backstory deep enough and to connect it to the specific story happening, right? And you know, I think that was very much a deliberate choice on his part. He's like, no, I just want you to keep turning the pages. Whereas, you know, there are a lot of other thrillers who, you know, will occasionally slow down. You get, you know, it's like you've had five really fast chapters. Now we're going to slow it down. Like, I think we see this in Jason Bourne, right? Those are also very intense, action-packed, you know, chapters that move you through the book very quickly. But there are several chapters as well that will, after several action pieces, we slow down. And we get to know Jason, and we get to, you know, understand him more.
Man, that's a great example, and I love that you brought up the trade-off. Because I think you're absolutely right that any time you're pushing one of these, you're probably sacrificing another.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, hopefully not always, but I do think that's a very common thing to consider.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you know, anytime you're going to world build, you're slowing down your plot to do that.
Big time.
You know?
And the pacing is just one of the biggest key factors in making it a good
so
plot.
Difficult.
Okay, so to help you out, I listed some reader diagnostic questions. So I'm assuming that you listeners are going to write a complete novel, and then you're going to share that with someone. And you need to know how they're perceiving your plot. And so a question you might say is, how many days did it take you to finish the book? And honestly, this is going to vary a lot by reader, but what you need to follow up with is figure out, how did it compare to other books you read? Did you read this slower? Did you read this quicker? How was that pacing? You can also ask them, what was your favorite scene? I also like to ask, what was your gut reaction to the ending? How did it make you feel? What did you think? And then this is a new one, so I listed it as bonus point. You're going to have to ask this before, but I just tested out this with Joe the other day, and I thought it worked brilliant. But ask them, say, predict the ending as you read. And so now for my Star Child book 3, I have what Joe is thinking the ending is pointing to. And it's interesting because that's something I can't see as an author. I've always known what the end was. And so it's hard for me to know what exactly have I made clear up until this point.
That is an excellent point. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I loved your predictions because it really shaped my concept of what my plot had pointed out to you. Okay, so next I just want to talk about Huckleberry Finn. On plot, it's weak. And if you look about just about any serious literary critique, they're going to say, yeah, the third act of Huck Finn sucks because it just turns into a Tom Sawyer novel. And it's this lighthearted, kind of frivolous, cheap. It's just not solid on plot. Well, and to be fair, I should say that all of my ratings on this little chart thing are in the positive. And these are novels I'm pointing out that have sold. I mean, they're classics or bestsellers. And they're all in the positive. So even though Huck Finn has a weak plot, I think it has a sufficient plot. And that's the same with Da Vinci Code and characterization, right? It has sufficient character. Now, if you're a brand new writer, it's quite possible that your maybe plot, say, would be in the negative. And that's a huge problem. That's not acceptable. And you need to bring that up to where it's at least a positive mark on your book. Okay, so Huck Finn... deep character novel. We get this kind of backwards boy who's an outcast from society, and he becomes friends with this a man named Jim, who's a slave. And Huck Finn has a moment where, so he, because of his upbringing, he believes that if he helps Jim the slave, he will go to hell. And to him, that's like, I will literally live in fire and brimstone for eternity. Like, that's what he believes. He says, if I help them, or if I help Jim, that's what's going to happen to me. And he has this internal moment where he decides, you know what? I'll go to hell then. Because he believes that it's more important to help this man who he sees as a real person. And that's just like this deep character moment. It's not really an outward thing. It's this internal struggle. And that's something you don't really get in Da Vinci Code so much. And that characterization is a big part of what makes Huck Finn such a classic. And then I also think it does decent on world, although like it immerses you in the deep South, but I don't feel like most people are drawn to that book because they want to get immersed in the deep South. That's kind of like a byproduct, in my opinion. Again, that's just me. But okay, so a couple of reader diagnostics. How many characters can you name? So they finish your novel and you say, now name me the characters. And if they can, if they name one, Robert Langdon, that's not that great. If they name, you know, 10, like, I mean, I think most readers of Harry Potter could easily just rattle off 10 characters, maybe 20. I mean, I think it would be a lot. And that...
Well, I think part of that is the length, right? Like, the more books in a series you read, the easier it is to recall the characters.
Yeah, that's totally fair. You can also ask some questions like, which character would you like to be friends with, or who did you identify with? Stuff like that can kind of give you a sense of which parts of your writing are resonating as far as character goes. I also just wanted to mention some other examples. I think The Martian has awesome science, right? And I'm going to call that world. But I think the reason that one made it into a Hollywood blockbuster movie is because it had this Mark Watney character who you loved going on the journey with. Anyway, two others, Catcher in the Rye, Chronicles of Prydain. And then I also wanted to talk about, I'm currently playing the video game, The Legend of Zelda, The Ocarina of Time.
Well, that's an old one.
Yeah. Going, dude, it's like, that was like, what do you call it?
Your childhood?
It was a building block of me getting into fantasy. It was like this really key piece.
Did you finish it as a kid?
Actually, no, I didn't.
Okay, so that's why you've gone back as an adult to this very old game. Okay.
Yeah. So I was noticing as I played the game. So I think what draws me to it is the world, right? The way I feel immersed in this fantasy setting. I just think it's super cool. I noticed in just the opening scenes, there's probably three different dialogues, and I don't even think you necessarily have to encounter all of the dialogue. But they'll say something like, it seems the time has come for the boy without a fairy to begin his journey. And it alludes to the fact that this character, the protagonist, is the only person in the village who never had a fairy, like never had a spirit companion as a guide. And I think that it's only alluded to, but it leaves a ton of room to dig into that and go deep on character. But I kind of thought this was an interesting example because this is a very successful game and franchise. And I think it's interesting that as long as you're kind of alluding to it poetically, it seems sufficient and you don't necessarily have to go deep. I like deep on character. Joe, I'm kind of like your mom as far as like I'm talking about the people in it.
Yeah.
But it's possible to do that without it. And I just thought it was cool to see that kind of alluded to, but then it's left alone because it's like, no, we got to do the world and we got to do the plot. Okay. So then last, I did the Fellowship of the Ring for world. And you'll notice on my slide that that one is literally going off the charts. So as far as plot goes, I mean, it's got a great plot, this mysterious ring. And someone who's not a typical hero is the only one who can carry it because otherwise it's too dangerous and it can turn you invisible. And the only way to get rid of it is to carry it literally into the heart of where the bad guy is. Like, that's a pretty good plot. Now, it's not Da Vinci Code level. Like, it meanders Tom Bombadil and stuff, right? There's some weaknesses there.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a difference there between the actual plot. Like, if we zoom out from the storytelling and look at the plot, I think it's a fantastic plot. In fact, I say this about the Tolkien's work all the time. He has an incredible plot. I don't think he's a very good storyteller because it meanders, like you said. Like, it goes off the rails a lot.
Yeah.
But if we look at the plot itself, I think it's a fantastic story, very, you know, well constructed. But then when we sat down to tell it, he got distracted by all the butterflies.
Yeah, that is so funny. Okay, so that's something hopefully we can touch on when we dive deeper in an episode on plot. Because, yeah, I think you're exactly right that storytelling, it's not just what happens, but it's how you say that it happens and how you keep that pacing going. And I just want to mention, so with Legolas character, right, we don't know exactly why he's joining the Fellowship. We know it's probably out of duty, maybe out of honor, something like that, but we're not getting in his head saying, well, I'd rather go to hell and help the Fellowship. You know, it's like, it's not a character novel. But the world is just, I just feel like, man, nothing can surpass it. It's just fantastic. Okay, so a couple reader diagnostics. Ask your readers, do you want to spend time in this place? And if your world is big on concept, do you wish this idea were real? Or
ooh, that's a good one.
Stuff like that. You want to dig into their feelings on what they think of the world that you've made and invited them into. Some examples. So I mentioned In the Heights earlier. So I'd listened to the soundtrack before, and I knew exactly what I was getting into.
And what is In the Heights? I don't remember you mentioning it earlier. And I don't know.
Oh, sorry. So it's a Broadway musical that was recently turned into a Hollywood musical.
Okay.
And it just came out a few weeks ago. But so I came out and I was just like, wow, that was so good. And she's like, man, it was boring. Nothing happened.
Your wife?
Yeah. Sorry. So we went and saw that together. And she's actually exactly right. Especially in the first half of the movie, very little happens. And the reason is because it's a world movie or show. And it's trying to invite you into New York City, specifically a suburb called Washington Heights. And it's trying to immerse you in this world. And that's basically all it does. There's very little like, oh no, this has happened. What are we going to do? Like, it's not really a plot thing. It's a world thing. And actually, I should mention, it's also really high on character. It goes deep into characters and motivations. Another world one I wanted to mention is Jurassic Park. And I actually think it has a stellar plot, and there's some hints at some really good character. But all you have to say is, what if dinosaurs could be brought back to life today? Like, that concept just blows my mind every time I think about it. That concept is the reason there are 6 movies out now, because it's hard to ever get enough of that concept. And the fact that he took that idea and ran with it, it's just like stellar. And then I wanted to mention an antithesis. I think it's interesting that when you read Shakespeare, like, Shakespeare's also just top notch, but when you look at the world in Shakespeare, it's hard to get at. And part of the reason is it was made to be on stage, and you're going to have a couple props and that's about it. And then you can take, say, Romeo and Juliet, and Baz Luhrmann, the director, takes it and puts it in modern day California. And all of a sudden you have this mind blowing setting alongside Romeo and Juliet. And that just does some crazy things. But the story alone can actually function very well with like hardly any setting other than to say, well, there were these 2 cities. Anyway, so just something to think about. There's world. We're getting a little low on time. Okay, so I'll dive into this last example, and then I think we're done. I recently read the novel Neuromancer.
Oh, you read Neuromancer?
Yeah, dude, it was cool. And I'm about to tell you why I think it's so cool.
Did you listen to our episode first, or did you just pick it up?
Oh, nope. Sorry. It's completely unrelated. I haven't listened to it yet. Wow. I need to. Well, here, Joe, put a plug in for your other podcast, because it deserves it.
I have another podcast where we dive deep into just stories. As we put it, right, like, do you remember that the first time you read that spellbinding story and – you know, or encountered it, whether it was, you know, watching a show or playing a game that just gripped you, and like you just forgot to sleep, you forgot your life and just lived there, right? Like, it just totally captivated you. Do you remember that? Our goal in Floor is to go into those stories that captivate people that way and just dive deep into the lore and into the backstory and some of the influences and just really explore them in that deep nerd way. So,
and so, listeners, I hope you'll go Google that. It's Lore, L-O-R-E, but
no,
with the
it's
F.
Floor.
With
the
F.
Oh, yeah.
Lore.
Yeah, Floor. Yeah, Lore with an F, spelling Floor.
And yeah, it's fantastic. I listened to their series on The Witcher, and man, it's just so good. And it's cool that it brings up all, it's like a discussion. It's the conversation that you wish you could have had that you just don't know enough nerds to actually have it.
That is a good way of putting that. Yeah. I'm going to use that in some of our advertising. You're like, this is the nerd discussion you want to have with all your friends. You just don't know enough of them.
Yeah, it's really good stuff. I highly recommend it. In particular, if you're reading a series that they're delving into, they've done a lot of really cool series. Okay.
So, back to Neuromancer.
I didn't know you'd done Neuromancer. I need to go listen to it. I feel a little lost.
So that is the cyberpunk introduction because cyberpunk came out of Neuromancer.
Yeah. So, I'm blanking on his name. Gibson.
Yes, Gibson.
He's the man who coined the phrase cyberspace, which I think is super cool.
Yeah.
And for those of you who don't know, it's kind of a story like The Matrix, where there's like reality and then there's this other cyberspace world. So I was reading it, and I was reading it as I was preparing for this lecture series, and I started to notice some interesting pieces coming together. So on page one, I'm going to read you this quote. The Chatsubo was a bar for expatriates. You could drink there for a week and never hear two words of Japanese. So already we're getting setting, right? This is world. This is telling us in very short order, it's telling us that it's surprising if there's no Japanese. So it's like this little island in some place that is submerged in Japanese, right? And then also that it's a bar. So it goes on, the bartender's smile widened. Now, this is talking about a person, a character, but I like to think of this as a braid because in describing this character, we're seeing the world. So the bartender smiled. His ugliness was the stuff of legend. In an age of affordable beauty, there was something heraldic about his lack of it. The antique arm whined as he reached for another mug. So we're seeing that, okay, this is a culture that can buy beauty, like you can re-sculpt yourself. And he has an antique arm that makes a sound as he moves it. So we're starting to understand. And this is like the first paragraph or so. It's right at the beginning. And already he's very clearly establishing this setting in this world. And you feel it. You're right there with him. Okay, so then a couple pages, actually probably same page, maybe next page, the hero is named Case. And it's talking about him. It says, a year here, and he still dreamed of cyberspace. All the speed he took and the corners he cut in Night City, and he'd still see the Matrix in his sleep. Bright lattices of logic unfolding across that colorless void. So this is telling us about Case, but it's also telling us more about the world, right? The Matrix and what that's like. The dreams came on in the Japanese night like live wire voodoo. And he'd cry for it, cry in his sleep, and wake alone in the dark, curled in his capsule in some coffin hotel, his hands clawed into the bed slab, trying to reach that console that wasn't there. So this paragraph is teaching us about what Case has been through and what he's like because of what he's been through. And yet at the same time, like the coffin hotel, you can see a bed that's like a coffin, right? It's drawing you into the setting, but it's also teaching you about character. So I just thought this was beautifully woven. Now, it's interesting that I had to get to about page 9 before I found what I thought was a really good example of plot, right? So that tells you something. Neuromancer is strong on world. It's strong on character. Maybe not as strong on plot. Now, that's debatable, and I don't know the novel well enough to defend it. Like, I chose other ones that I did know pretty well. And this one, like I said, I need to go watch Floor or listen to Floor. But so let me read you this example of how they build the plot in. So he starts talking to this woman. The woman says, Wage wants to see you with a hole in your face. She lit her own cigarette. So we have cigarettes in the world, grungy world. It's also telling us about her character. Like she's telling him he's going to die nonchalantly. Like that's interesting character, but it's doing both of those things while it's telling us the plot. And Case says, who says rats? You've been talking to rats. She says, no, Mona, her new squeeze is one of Wage's boys. Kay says, I don't owe him enough. He does me. He's out the money anyway. He shrugged. And then she says, too many people owe him now, Case. Maybe you get to be the example. You seriously better watch it. So 9 pages in, now it's like, okay, not only this guy suffering withdrawals, but they're going to kill him because he's involved in money and he's indebted. I just thought this was a great example of the braid in action. We're doing all 3 of those points. We're doing them very well, very concisely. And right up front, the reader knows, here's the world I'm in. Here's what's about to happen, and here's who it's happening to. I just thought it was a stellar example. Huh. Okay. Oh, sorry. Did you want to?
Oh, no. No. That's good.
Cool. So I just want to review. I hope you accomplish the objective today to figure out what it is, which of those 3 pillars you're strong at and which needs some work. Over the next few weeks, we're going to dive into each of those 3 pillars specifically, and I'm going to talk about some things that I do, some things that have been helpful for me. And I'll just say, so Joe already claimed plot and world, and I can vouch for him. He's very good at those 2. I like to think that I'm pretty good at character and decent at world, and I got to work on plot. I think that's a weakness for me. Anyway, I'll share with you some things that I think have helped me to improve on those. And yeah, I think that's all I have. Any final comments?
Yeah, I definitely think I'm weak on character. I mean, it's something I spend a lot of time thinking about because of it. For me, plot comes naturally, and I'm writing in the real world, so I think that's an easier thing to do. I started writing a fantasy and took a few chapters to my group, and it became very apparent that my world was weak. In the current state of things where I'm writing, not contemporary but historical, I think it's easy to lean into the history as the world, so I don't have to build that. But I definitely think character is a place where I struggle, and I definitely have hit some chords. I've created a few characters that worked really well, and I just need to do what I have done for them to the whole cast instead of just a character or 2. I think you and I have had this discussion before. In the first novel in my series, the villain is very well done, and a lot of people comment on him, but the rest of the characters don't stand up as effectively because they're not as well done.
Well, you're in the company of Dan Brown, and that's pretty good company.
So, all right, great episode. Thank you.
Yeah, everyone, thank you for listening, and thank you for watching if you watched. It's time to start writing.